Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. I want to give a big thank you to Shah Karim, who will be speaking with us this hour. Shah is the CEO of SafeRock, a company that serves global and regional companies in North America and Europe, and has deep experience with digital transformation for the consumer, industrial, e-commerce, food, retail, education, and energy sectors. Welcome, Shah.
Great to be here with you. Great to be here. This time of pandemic, right? We're navigating our way through.
It's a crazy time, but at least we have our interviews
That's right.
and
That's
our
right.
virtual tools to keep us going.
That's right. That's right.
So, everyone, this interview is an element of IRI's Digital Transformation Community, the DXC, and it's a community of organizations that are on the journey toward digital transformation. Through the DXC, you can access case studies with fresh, relevant content. The latest one on DuPont is available on our website. We also have facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics, updates with insights and additional resources, and then webinar interviews with thought leaders like the one we're doing today. These will always take place on the third Thursday of the month, and I'll have information on the December interview shortly. And I'll be sure to sign all of you up to receive updates on the DXC if you don't already have them. And if you don't wish to receive them, just let me know. Just a few housekeeping items before we can get started here. First, this session is being recorded, and you will get a link to the recording. We will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will not be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can type your question in and I will read it out for you, or you can raise your hand using that function on the dashboard. All right, let's go ahead and get started. All right. So let's start with leadership, Shah. How do you stay the course and still be understanding in these crazy and difficult times?
You know, Lee, that's a great starting point. And I'd love to share with you what I've seen in my discussions with management and with companies during the course of this year. Starting in about February or March, I started reaching out to companies discussing how they see us going through this process. And what came out very early on was that leadership matters. Of course, there's a desire to draw on subject matter experts because we need to look at these topics in greater detail. But the importance of leadership in terms of the values they bring to the process, how they are supportive of their teams and their organization, the experience they have to shed light on familiar topics, also bringing the right people on the bus, Jim Collins, good to great. And getting them to the right seat is more important than ever. And you know, the bus nowadays needs to have the right engine on it as well as have a GPS to guide us to where we want to go to, right? Staying the course for leadership, getting more information, examining situations from different points of view, understanding that teams matter, that diverse thinking helps us to understand, to decide, and decide when to tack, when to adjust. Also, at the leadership level, having the understanding to be supportive of your team, to be collaborative, to weave a fabric, shall we say, so that team members can take risks and fall back if they don't succeed, and have the opportunity to be supported when they do succeed. And in this, there's a moment of truth that you have to, before you take the decision, to step back and pause, but also listen not just to the factual information, also listen with empathy, to see and say, I hear you, I understand your challenges, to the extended team. Now, we are, as you kindly mentioned, a strategy and analytics firm. And we provide big data solutions also focused on improving customer engagement and shareholder value and technology that we can also invest in partnerships. And to set the stage, I'd like to explain a little bit, if I can, a couple of examples of what we've done in the strategy side and then move directly into some operational sector-specific technology type of things, which I think will be interesting and engaging. So may I do that?
Oh, please do. Yeah.
Okay. It's great to have you here. By the way, I must say, IRI is a great organization, and I feel privileged to have the opportunity to speak in front of your audience and to have this discussion with you. As a couple of examples, a few years ago, we were involved in advising a national chain, which got an activist investor on board unexpectedly. And we advised the management team in terms of their go private strategy. The end result was that this $6 billion organization was sold at a 39% premium to market value. And we were working with the team, the internal management team, all through the entire cycle. A second example would be a private equity firm with whose portfolio companies we supported to create a shared services model that centered in the US, covered 12 countries in Europe, and reached out and brought in suppliers who were in Asia into a single workflow environment. And the third example from the strategy side would be a consumer electronics firm, one of the top five globally, which was undergoing a transformation from being a B2C company to a B2B company. And we were involved in several different aspects in terms of specifying which markets to enter, where to make strategic acquisitions, and doing valuations. So that's what that's a little bit of a background of where we are. And stepping back into our picture here, what we face today, and the members in IRI are part of that environment. Let me paint a quick macro picture of the dislocation that we're in, because I think that'll be helpful for context. Firstly, in the broader macro sense, there is a significant dislocation between the nominal market and the real economy. And by the nominal market, we mean the stock market, which are very frothy. The Fed is printing money and providing tremendous credit support. Fiscal stimulus has been in excess of $2.6 trillion pumped in to the economy. And you've seen that in the form of the PPP loans, the CARES Act, and so on. On the other hand, the real economy is suffering very badly, right? The Fed has put out a stress test where their severe scenario assumes that real estate prices go down 35% based on the CPPI, which is the price index for commercial property. The GDP goes down 12%, minus 12%, and unemployment, as we unfortunately know, hits above an 8.5% stride. And so this is a very big gap. And the problem with having a gap is that do we end up with a hard landing, which impacts equity values, corporate values, and then other types of dysfunction in the economy. And note, Warren Buffett, who is an amazing icon for all of us, on May 4th, when he had the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting this year, there are two different things that came out from them, which emphasize this split between what's happening in the nominal market and real market. He said, one, never bet against America, because he is the eternal optimist. And at the same time, company noted that there had been a $50 billion equity loss through their portfolio. Okay. So this means that our management in our companies have to be more thoughtful. And from my personal opinion, and of course, this is only limited to what I know, what I have experienced, and then my circle, which is going to be very specific. And I'm sure I can always learn more. But these are the three points that I understand. One, they want to have greater clarity on what's going on. And I'll explain what I mean by that through the examples later. Second, they want to have an opportunity to look around the corner even if it's a very small look, even if it is at 1%, 2% addition to what they already know. And the reason they want to do this is they want us in the companies to be able to win every market, right? That's the ultimate driver. Of course, in the meantime, we have to keep the lights on. So management does have a responsibility to retain jobs and talent and monetize data and apply these learnings to improve shareholder value. Now, I know we have covered the macro and the management picture. And now let's, the other part to this, let me explain what I mean by shareholder. It's an investor in the company, which may be a private equity firm. It may be a creditor also, or some form of financial sponsor, right? And there's also stakeholders who go beyond that. Well, the executive point of view, including the shareholders, when they focus on the company in this environment, I'll lay out a couple of use cases, the questions that go through the minds of management. One is, what is my stabilization plan? Where are my growth markets? Where am I weak? And once I understand that, how do I lay out my financial budget and operating plan for next year and better manage risk through this pandemic? How, for example, especially looking at R&D and the future capital requirements, how do I manage my capital investments and ensure that they are adequate while also meeting shareholder needs, right? So this is for my company internally. And they also have to look outwards towards Wall Street and answer questions such as, how do I manage market expectations and satisfy Wall Street for public companies, not for private, but for public ones? And then on another extreme, what is our action plan regarding short interest and activist investors, which puts downward pressure on the company? Then I'll just touch upon one other thing in terms of macro picture that weigh in on the executive management. Investors, what is their point of view in terms of outsized opportunities? So this is through some discussions that I have with friends and colleagues in private equity firms or with banks or with institutional entities, including analysts. One, there are three areas there's many more than three, but there's three areas where I think there's outsized opportunities. Because one is where there are mega trends. So you're talking about the FANG companies, right? Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, because those mega trends have been accelerated through the dislocation that we see during this pandemic. High touch is going to frictionless, effectively. And anything that drives us towards that, you've accelerated that cycle, that inevitable cycle that was going on. You might have, in 1 month, you might have had 3 years worth of gradual change take place. The second area of opportunity for outsized ones is where there are misunderstood or unloved companies, which may have cheap debt on their book. And these are some specific sectors. It's going to be real estate for sure. There'll be certain B2B, industrial, and other companies that infrastructure warehouse that we think are going to be affected. And then the third one is strong companies in strong sectors. So this is the other side of it, that private equity firms and investors wish to invest to consolidate. So they're looking around the corner. They say, look, we have deeper pockets. We have dry powder. And we know that this is an important, if they believe in a sector, then they'll say, I'll invest in the strongest guy that I can funnel resources through when the number two and number three players fall by the wayside. And this way I'll get outsized benefits and outsized multiples. So Lee, over to you. This is my thought on the macro and the leadership position. Does this make sense to you?
It does. It does. There's a lot to unpack there, obviously, though. So, but, you know, we've only got an hour. But so, you know, what do you see as the actual industry challenges for operational and digital, particularly with regard to, you know, chemical, food, and aerospace industries?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. That's a great question. That's a great question. And I hope this will be interesting. And like I said, you know, I believe that operational digital excellence provides a key win. And this will be at the divisional or the group level, just a notch below to support the executive outlook and decision making. And perhaps a couple of the questions that one would consider there. And I'd love to hear if these are on target or not, is one, how do I go about operational restructuring and cost reduction? Can I unpack and understand in greater detail demand and supply by market? Can I link my supply chain and manufacturing directly line of sight to the customer? How do I, and then turning to more specific questions on R&D, how do I spend more on R&D at this time or less? Because I need to understand the risk around it. And how do I grow my business from Horizon 1 to Horizon 2 and Horizon 3, meaning from my core markets into nearby adjacent markets and then onto new markets? By the way, my answer to these last two questions is yes, that one should consider those, but maybe in baby experiments. In terms of specific examples, what I'd like to do, if I may, is explore these sectors. One, I'm going to talk about COVID just a little bit. Then I'll talk about the food and the chemicals and the energy space, ENP. And what I'll do is I'll provide a specific example of how we've tackled a problem in terms of the description, the bottom line need that was there, what we did, and then the end result. And then this will hopefully give some food for thought and some corroborative points that will be beneficial. Is that okay if I go through that process, Lee?
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good plan.
Okay, great. So I look at COVID. The reason I'm saying COVID is that this is actually impacting the entire progress and pace of the economy. And interestingly enough, we've had, I'm not going to say neck deep, we're knee deep in this process. Okay. So a company asked us that COVID explained to us that COVID was playing havoc with their business. They couldn't predict traffic, couldn't plan staffing or how to plan for reopening and recovery. And unfortunately, this is on the front line. The end result that we had with them was good. The bottom line was that the company needed to predict traffic in order to get refinancing because they had to go to a bank, Bank of America, to get their lines of credit re-upped. And what we did here was that we stepped back. This is probably about March or April. Since then, we started to gather daily data on a national basis across 2,300 counties so that it would be national in scope and covers 90% of the U.S. population for COVID incidence and rates, which is now available on a number of different dashboards, along with mobility data, which means where people are spending time after the recovery. And then what we did, having this national or quasi-national, it's 90% of the U.S. population, most of all the significant SMSAs. We built multiple models that separately analyzed COVID and causality associated with it, and then mobility and causality associated with that. And third, we combined those two so we could see the impact of a rise in one impacting the other and noted how much of a lag effect there was. Then we embedded the actual company information in terms of where the company was located, where its offices and stores were, to be able to predict mobility by county and location. The end result here was there was a successful refinancing. That was one. Number two, they were able to have an effective reopening plan by location. And three, they were able to conserve cash by knowing where to open first, how to allocate their dollars, dividing up the next dollar, and how do I spread it out, as well as this new budget of cleaning that all of us companies now have as a line item which I have to allocate and prioritize because I have limited funds to work with. Where do I go first? Where do I go second? As well as staffing and developing lean procedures. And this provides a direct line of sight to customers, which will also help with SIOP meetings, which is for sales, inventory, and operations generally. Interestingly enough, this goes on to other sectors as well. Let me move to food from COVID. So once you have that national database that we have and we have models proven on it, now we can embed different types of companies and sectors into it. So on the food side, a national brand was suffering from out of stock in terms of, and we've seen that with the Lysol products and the Clorox and the tissue papers not being available. And, you know, the opportunity is not just in that rush from the pandemic, but generally also it's a problem having out of stock and dissatisfied customers. And while they had increased their spend on inventory, that didn't seem to stem the challenge. So the bottom line here was that they had a potential loss of revenue and dissatisfied customers. If this problem wouldn't get solved, they would end up with a competitive disadvantage and potential disruption from others on the sideline, a second tier competitor who might come and disrupt us, as potentially we're having with automobiles, with the oil and gas being used and being potentially displaced by electric. So what we did here was we said, let's focus on improving the forecast. And the question we ask is at the core of it, where's the white space? Where's the chink in the armor or the methods that they have? And we concluded with the team that the most important thing was baseline, being able to improve on the baseline estimates they have. This is important for manufacturing. It's important for distribution purposes and understanding market by market what's happening. And many models use last year as a baseline, but history doesn't repeat itself, especially during a pandemic. So we developed unique algorithm using what we call recency model, which includes seasonality, holidays, pricing regimes, comp store pricing, promotions, and segmentation for over 100,000 SKUs. Each SKU got a unique model, which was then rolled up to a category level. Basically, we ended up creating a data cube, a completely consistent data cube, which you could slice and dice every which way. From a category point of view, from a SKU point of view, from a brand, location, or management point of view. And the end result was this accurately measured ROI because the baselines were smarter. It reduced out of stock, moving them towards full pricing. And total sales increased 19.6% over a four-year period with them, with marketing costs going down 12.4%. With decision making, you know, it's starting from very basic parts. The third sector I'd like to give an example on is in chemicals, and this is a problem that a friend of mine who is lovely and extremely thoughtful explained to us that the market is cyclical, and that supply and demand have different types of cycles and they don't match. So when you invest in the supply part, plans are multi-year investments, and it takes, and they scale up my production, but it's a big spike, and then it takes multiple years to amortize that. On the other hand, demand is very cyclical. You know, it wiggles around a lot from year to year. When there's a low price, it's not profitable for me, so I might pull back on what I output, and when the prices go high, I can't keep up with the demand. So I get whipsawed. And how can I better predict supply and demand? This will be necessary for their strategic review for 2021 and for budget allocations. Well, when we looked at this at the bottom line, we agreed that there needed to be a different way to analyze the market and reduce uncertainty. And what we suggested was to take the same approach and borrow from the outlook that we took on the food side, but take it a little bit further. Take the model and cut it up into three parts. Immediate needs for forecasting, which would be using tools like AI or machine learning to do 1 hour ahead, 1 day ahead, 1 week ahead, very short-term forecasting, very accurate in that space. Then look at the second part, which would be 1 month to 1 year, and create models for that, which would allow me to understand what factors are causal factors and model those and monitor those and then reflect that into the output. And then the third part, which is a point of view driven, when you go beyond a year, which is Warren Buffett territory, way above my my understanding, to provide medium and long term point of view of which way the industry is headed. So breaking this up into three parts allows different parts of the organization to tackle and solve them. And then you can bring it back together again to create a better output. And I'll go into that's the third example. And the fourth one in energy, exploration and production, E&P companies. So an energy company found it was making tough budget decisions which were not as productive as they like, because they were not, they could see at the end of the year that it would have been better to have had a different allocation. They didn't get enough ROI, shall we say, from their capital investments. So the bottom line here was that management faced inconsistent results. Their production estimates were could have been improved upon. And when they were doing the budget allocation meeting at the C-level annually, the sharpest elbows in the room won. So it wasn't fact-based, data-based decisions. I mean, it was, but it was limited by the accuracy and quality of the information they had around production and EUR. So estimated ultimate recovery, what the total value of that well is. So we dug into this and we found there were two sets of challenges which had to be separated out and handled independently. The first one, which is very interesting and unexpected, we found that engineers and management, and by the way, in E&P, you have smarter people, more PhDs and statisticians than you'll probably see anywhere else. It's quite amazing, the talent that's on board there. But we found that they tended to underestimate the larger fields and the larger estimates. And that's actually a human behavioral trait, right? If you go to a casino and you're going to bet on something, or you're going to make a purchase, you think more carefully about the larger purchases than the smaller ones. You're going to spend a lot of money. It's easier to do it on smaller pieces than on a very large chunk. So one, we saw that this was impacting their estimation and biasing it downward. The second one, which was also a little unexpected when we got into the technology and the weed of it, is that they were treating the production problem as a spreadsheet exercise when it really wasn't. It needed big data behind it. So this company had 12,000 wells in the Eagle Ford Basin in Texas. So it's not insignificant. But the methodology that they were using was insignificant. What we did was to convert this into a big data problem. And I'm not going to go into the technical details because it is fairly complicated. But what we ended up doing was for each well, see, what they would do is they would take those 12,000 wells, divide that basin up into four parts or eight parts by business unit, and say, here's my average expected result for, and they give eight numbers, right? For the 12,000 wells. We created dynamic systems for each well. So we had 12,000 models, which would dynamically update every time a new data point came out. And that led to more efficient production forecasts and more accurate EUR. So we looked at where the white space was, what is the chink in the armor, and were unafraid to get granular. And I think those are three guidelines. The end result, by the way, was that the system using public data compared against Wall Street analysts was 76% more accurate than experts. I almost fell out of my chair when I heard that. That means on three out of four wells, literally, we would be closer to actual production than the experts. So anyway, that's the power of those things. And let me take a minute to talk about the aerospace sector, and which is an incredible area, which has complex sourcing processes because the planes that are being built, and the problem is that there are thousands of parts. Each element has cost, durability, and weight parameters that they have to ensure are appropriate. There's research readiness, technical readiness, production readiness considerations for every component. And that's just the hardware. And then there are systems that are equally complex, guiding the engine when it's isolated and off into the air. And there's people and compliance issues. So it's hats off, probably the most incredibly complex environments, one of the ones that we'll ever come across that exist. The bottom line here is that there's dependence on large number of sole source suppliers. There's long lead times. There's financial challenges across the supply chain for new programs. There's large inventory needs, and there's a need to collaborate across complex supply chain. Not to mention that on top of that, we have cyber and security issues nowadays. Well, those are big honking challenges, okay? What can be done? Again, look at the chink in the armor, very small white space, and let's see what we can do. And the opportunity here is to improve, at least in our opinion, one place. There are many others, and I'll defer to the real experts, but something that we truly believe is valuable is to look at the community, improve internal and supplier workflows, establish a single source of truth for all departments, which we've seen be very effective in multiple other markets, which have supply chains not as complex as this, but very varied. And then tie this in with a just-in-time data entry process, which can link all suppliers. It's very fact-based, getting everybody on the same page, taking a sequential process, breaking it up into parallel, assign the responsibility for information. So different people own different parts of this large fact sheet, shall we say, about each product. And the end result that we've seen elsewhere that we would love to try into the aerospace sector is the opportunity to repurpose approved components. So we've seen this, for example, with lead paint on toys being imported from China. It's a compliance requirement, and how do you take that type of thing and make it very easy to share out and ensure happens properly? And when you take this and you can apply it, the success comes when you can apply this across Horizon 2 and Horizon 3, for example, to develop product variations as well as products for completely new markets, because that drives down costs, and we've seen that happen quite successfully. And one other sector which I think has a very interesting potential for support, and I'll just mention, is in packaging, where you have food safety, you have cans, you have health, you have global wastage, and you have the eyes of the ESG lens that investors and mutual funds globally are putting on this sector, so which has problems and opportunities. Over to you, Lee. What do you think? Does that make sense?
Yeah, particularly with regard to the packaging, we've got several members in that space, and sustainability is becoming a huge issue for them. And you know, frankly, I'm glad to see that it's something that they're tackling. So just bearing all this in mind, what are the end results and value propositions that IRI members should be seeking? Do you have any tips or tricks?
Yeah, hopefully they're tips, they're not tricks, because you can't fool.
Come on now, let's get the good stuff.
Yeah, I'll give you a baker's dozen of points, and baker's dozen. So 13 of these will be basically, actually, they were scattered through these examples. And as I was thinking about it, I did list it, but it's not in any particular order, and hopefully some of these will make sense, but that's up to you, and I'd love to, you know, hear back about this. So the end results to look at that we saw, we heard people not just talk about, but also willingness to act on and put muscle behind, reopening plan, conserving cash, line of sight to customer was important, ROI, how to measure it in a consistent way, in a repeatable way, reducing risk, reducing out of stock, increasing sales and EBIT, and reducing costs. Uncertainty, which is slightly different from, which is related to the risk part, accuracy of forecasts, understanding, unbundling the supply and demand bit by bit, so that I can get just a little bit more clarity. Even if I can just get 2% more clarity, it helps my management team support them. Resilience of supply chain was another very important part that I think is valuable when you have global supply chains. And I think what probably one of my favorites is the opportunity to repurpose across Horizon 1, Horizon 2, and Horizon 3. And by repurpose, I don't mean necessarily the product itself, but also taking decision steps that are sequential and making them parallel. The objective is making my organization more nimble, more agile, because that'll improve in my time to market and eventually in the value of the company. Over to you. What do you think, Lee?
You know, I agree. It's such a tricky topic, though, and I know that our members are trying multiple different ways of approaching this. You know, let's move on to talking about opportunities. You know, how does supply and demand factor into this?
So what I would say is, I would, in terms of opportunities, there are three or four things that come to my mind and take priority. Supply and demand for sure. Along with that is data monetizing. I would bring those two together and deal with it under opportunities. Understanding the customer in terms of point of view and keeping the customer at the heart of all decisions. And then focusing on the financial runway in terms of KPI and metrics. So I'd bring these four together. And particularly in the financial runway, one lesson I've learned, and it's been a good discipline, which we've learned at the feet of private equity owners who understand this very well, is to push for getting your ROI within a year. So chunk your projects up to be within, to have achievements within the budget cycle. And then you know that you've always picking up some benefit along the way, and try to focus on that 1 year lens to give you the value back, and that should be the goal that you that one works with. So that's what I would say. I talked about some of the examples and how they've gone about it, but bringing these together in these areas, I think, makes it relevant for our times. Look, our goal is to deliver outsized value and to reduce risk, and that then, you know, becomes part of the strategy that one should explore. Lee, what do you think?
Well, so another huge opportunity space is in data. Can you speak to that?
I would bring together the monetizing of that with the opportunities. What I would just add is that, and I know that data monetizing is a buzzword, and I'm victim, I always use that, but the monetizing is a subpart of making data-driven decisions. So you make data-driven decisions, part of which might be monetizing data, other part of it is to use data to improve my ecosystem, my company's use, and my internal decision-making. So I bring those two together and associate it along in the opportunities with the supply and demand, understanding the customer point of view, and financial runway, which must be front and center in today's discussion. Over to you.
So let's end, and we'll open the floor for questions after this one. You know, let's look at improving company value. You know, what recommendations do you have for our strategy there? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and that's an important part. And one, there is not a formula for doing this. In some cases, there may be, but the types of things I'm talking about are the more complex challenges, not the spreadsheet level cutting and dividing. I'm not into, the focus here is you have to team together, be bringing creative, financial, and organizational experience into a single group. Dig deep, carefully, but fearlessly. Add financial, people, and operating perspectives. And all of this is to support the decision making. But just one pause before the decision making is to consider the white space that exists. What hasn't been done? Where is a chink in my armor or in my flaw in my thinking that might be in a tough space, but if we can solve it, get better? And my belief is that these simple things allow us to deliver outsized value and reduce risk. And we've been working over the past year on a restructuring where there's a brand rationalization that has to be done with sales of brands, debt restructuring, and a new co being put together. And, basic blocking and tackling goes a long way. And that's on the strategy side. On the technology side, one of the things I would say in terms of improving value, and this is getting more operational, it's not just strategy. One approach we've taken is to establish a pilot and suggest you do that, a small, maybe 10 or 12 week pilot to measure ROI and get a before and after snapshot that you put together. And the first part of it would be to prepare the ROI in a joint team and document the business case so that you can put it forward to management. And I'm talking very executional here. And then the second part of that would be to roll out to an organization. What you do in the initial phase, and let me talk about the data monetization part of this. Let's make this data oriented. Check the requirements, do a timing estimate, figure out who needs to be involved, how the results would be reviewed, and then what you would do post-review. In a larger complex situation, you may need a steering committee consisting of the right people on the team who can define the goals and deliverables, discuss and decide on recommendations, and have the seniority to escalate this and remove boulders out of the pathway in front of us. The second level there is you have the project lead and the project teams, who will do the project steering and liaison, coordination and communication of results, and if required, get input on specific topics from specialist experts from inside the company or subject matter experts. And then you'll have a project team, let's say on a specific data side, who will be responsible for the collection, the execution of the analysis, and the documentation of results. And once you've completed all of this, this is the first part of getting internal buy-in. Then you have to figure out how you do the implementation in small group, departmental, or divisional rollout. And then you get into the cycle of doing all of this within a one-year period so you can verify, review, and refine results. And I think at IRI, with your membership, you have these and other interesting problems that we'd love to partner on, and I think merit deeper exploration. And why don't we explore these issues together and create value? That's what I think should be one of the thoughtful goals for SafeRock and for IRI and your membership. Look, in sum, if one were to step back and think about it, there's no silver bullet, right? These are trying times, and we can do good, and we can support our management team through this process. Understand, help them to understand the rock face of reality, gather the facts, get different points of view. Diversity matters here. Once you have the information, you be decisive, but make smaller bets, in my opinion, if you can avoid having to make a larger one immediately. And then it's basic blocking and tackling. I'll tie this back to the leadership topic that we had at the beginning that we started with. We talked about strategy, we talked about analytics, but on top of all of this is culture and the role that our leaders play in fostering an inclusive and productive and supportive culture is very important. As Peter Drucker said, you know, the famous quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast. So that leadership and that culture comes first. It provides the framework for us to succeed. And then you have components such as strategy, operational tasks, and execution. Over to you. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to actually put it right to our attendees here who've already got the questions coming in. So, you know, we've got one from Rich Hollander. So he asks, where does creativity and merchandising fall into this conversation?
That's a great question, and thank you for that. So creativity is a part that you can't enumerate, right? It's innate. And creativity in merchants, the point is to support them with data-driven decisions or data-driven facts so they to guide the range of discussion. So absolutely, it's complementary to that. The point is that they should serve their need and purpose. So you go in armed with facts into the meeting at a GMM level or at a VP level for capital allocation use it to sharpen outcomes. That's my thought on that. Thank you for that question.
All right, do we have any other questions? And feel free to either type them in or you can raise your hand and I'll call on you and unmute you so that you can put your question directly to Shaw.
And it's, you know, we've covered a lot of ground here and thank you, Lee, for providing the guidance and the framework here. Are there other thoughts that you have yourself, Lee, that are pressing on the IRI membership side that come up for your consideration?
You know, sorry, we just had another question come in, and I want to make sure we take care of audience questions before I get my chance. So, another one from Rich, how can you use data to create in-store experiences?
That's POP and packaging companies. Lee, you got to put in touch with the packaging companies to bring this together, right? It's a great question, and you know, some of your members are thinking about it, and if they're not, they will be in terms of being creative and engagement. And you know, some of these new technologies of how you search as you walk down the aisle, you know, and it's converting from a generational thing to being everywhere. People are looking, and it's not just the creative part, but it's information. They want information that they can make a decision in, and some of it is price-driven decisions. Sometimes it is a fashion issue, or it'll be a product features, and they'll be checking it as you walk down the aisle in a store. So this is now being picked up, and companies are providing, actually they're supporting the servers and the data to be in-house. They're encouraging it, and it's something that, you know, the world of change with Amazon, right? What a fast-paced rate of change we have now, and hopefully this will make us better and more effective as we go forward into the future.
How do you think that's being impacted by the pandemic and the massive change in the way we shop now?
Yeah, well, look, malls and retailers are in a tizzy, right? They'd love to do new things, but I think the financial runway is hitting them very hard. They have scant resources to do things with, firstly. If you have deep enough pockets, then you can go ahead and explore. But, you know, there's all these acronyms in there, BOPIS and the buy online and pick up in store and various combinations around that, which have provided some success, some clarity. I mean, look, I've been getting all our groceries delivered to the front door and then bringing it inside. I haven't gone out to that many stores, even though it's a fabulous experience. It's accelerating the change, no question about it. 3 years worth of change in 3 months. That's all over. And if it goes back, the punt, you know, even though people think that it might sort of be like an elastic band where it goes back, I don't think it's going to be, in my opinion, what we're seeing so far, going to be reverting back. We are not going to be back to where we were before, definitely not. And the economy will not be functioning in the same way. It'll be different. It'll be more resilient. There'll be more flexibility. It may be smaller, but that's okay. That's my answer.
Yeah, you know, a lot of our members are spending, probably all of our members are spending a lot of time this fall, you know, during the planning season for 2021, you know, developing different scenarios and trying to figure out just how they're going to make sure that they're agile enough to be able to respond to whatever 2021 brings. It's a huge challenge, and we're all kind of, you know, the blind leading the blind here, and you know, just trying to do our best, I think.
It's not just the, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And it affects organizations also, right? You're going to a virtual conferences. How do we link and encourage and foster the community? These are all important questions that they're wading through. So, yeah, so it's great. Do we have any other questions, or do we give time back to people now?
Yeah, I think that's a good ending point. It's not the cheeriest ending point, but I think it's a good ending point. And I don't see any other questions that have come in. So I just want to say a huge thank you to you, Shah, for joining us today and for the time that you put into thinking through all these issues for us.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of our attendees for joining us and for listening today and for contributing their thoughts. So as a reminder, the podcast will be available, and I'll send you the link as soon as it's able to be downloaded and uploaded and all the things I need to do. I hope to see you at our next thought leader interview, which will be the third Thursday in December. And I'll have more details on that shortly. All right.
Thank you, everyone.
And thank you, Shah, so much.
Absolutely. You're a great organization, and we want to do what we can to support you.
All right. Fantastic. Thanks, and have a great rest of your day.
Okay.